welcome to the Fansmanship.com podcast, coming to you from San Luis Obispo, California, with Andy Stevens, Owen Main, and Luke Johnson.
As Big Dave said, welcome to the Fansmanship.com podcast. It's Owen here, podcast episode 63. Today I spoke with the Royal We. I spoke with Chris Jackson. He is the baseball writer for the Albuquerque Examiner, or at examiner.com. And he joined us. He's a native of Albuquerque who also lived in Southern California. We talked about all kinds of things, including Cal Poly and New Mexico getting into their respective regionals. We talked about the Big West Conference and baseball and college baseball in Southern California. We also talked about the Dodgers AAA team, the Albuquerque Isotopes. We talked about the history of the Albuquerque Dukes, which were the Dodgers AAA team off and on for a lot of years, and why they're not called the Dukes anymore, how the name Isotopes came to be, what kind of a baseball town Albuquerque is. It's pretty interesting. And whether there are actual Dodger fans in Albuquerque, and why it might be fun to go see a game there. I also talked with him about a few of the Dodgers farmhands, guys who are in the farm system or who have been in the farm system, getting kind of sent back and forth in and out, including D. Gordon and Yasiel Puig and a number of other players. And he had some cool stories about guys like A.J. Ellis and so forth. So hope you enjoy it. I sure did enjoy talking to Chris. This is the Fansmanship.com podcast. I'm joined on the podcast now by Chris Jackson. Chris is from the Albuquerque Examiner.com and is the, I guess you could call him the beat writer for the Isotopes. That's what you call it. I mean, everything baseball in Albuquerque, it seems like Chris follows. Yeah. Would you say that's correct?
I would say that's correct. Yeah, pretty much all the college and pro.
And so as far as colleges go in Albuquerque, who are we talking about? The Lobos?
Yeah, New Mexico Lobos.
Okay. And what other New Mexico-like colleges are there, and are they very good at baseball? Like New Mexico State?
New Mexico State's down Las Cruces, up in the southern part of New Mexico. They're the Aggies. They play, and they're still in the WAC for baseball.
Right.
And then we've got... we have three Division II colleges in the state. Two of them play baseball: New Mexico Highlands, which is up in Las Vegas, which is I-25 toward Colorado.
Okay.
Eastern New Mexico, which is in Portales, which is near the Texas border.
Got it. I think Cal Poly actually played Eastern New Mexico last year in basketball locally here. The New Mexico baseball team got a 3 seed in the Fullerton regional today. Was that where they belong, do you think? And what kind of a shot do they have as far as making some waves in the regional?
I think a 3 is, I mean, it really doesn't matter if you're a 2 or 3.
Right.
That's match again. So, that's pretty much where they were this year. The Mountain West had some great individual players this season. I think there's possibly up to 3 guys who will go in the first round out of the conference. But the strength of the teams as a whole, it wasn't as strong as the conference has been in the past. I think the Lobos, they can hit. There's no question they can hit. They've always been able to hit. They're not a home run team. They're more of a doubles and triples kind of team.
Uh-huh.
They really have one power hitter, DJ Peterson. He's probably going to go somewhere between the 9th and 14th pick in the draft. So.
Wow.
Very, very talented right-handed hitting first baseman. He also plays third base. Might end up in left field as a pro. We'll see. The Lobos' biggest problem is they remind me a lot of a Pepperdine team back in 2004. And that year, Pepperdine went to Fullerton, and they played Arizona State, just like the Lobos are going to, and they pull off the mild upset in the first round, and they beat Fullerton in the second round. And then they get to the third game, and they had no pitch left. And that's been the Lobos' problem. They don't have a Sunday starter. They've rotated about 5 or 6 different guys in that spot this year. And it's what kind of killed them in the conference tournament. They sent their 2 best starters out for the first 2 games. They won both games easily, and they get to play in San Diego State and kaplooey. And they don't really have the pitching depth this season. A lot of the guys they were counting on just, you know, some of the junior college transfers didn't really pan out. And I think some of the freshmen, you know, they're good for a while, but they're still freshmen. And eventually I think a lot of them just kind of ran out of gas and kind of hurt them in the end. So, you know, if they're able to go out there, if they win, you know, if they can pull that off and win the first two games, you know, anything can happen. But the odds are against them actually came out of that regional, especially as tough as Arizona State and Fullerton are this year.
Now, you mentioned Pepperdine. You spent some time working in Southern California, right, before you went back to Albuquerque?
Yeah, I went to college in Arizona and worked there after college for about 3 years. Spent about 5 years total in Los Angeles, four of those actually working, and then the fifth year with mostly just sitting around trying to find another job before I sort of retreated back to the land of the cheap rent and all that stuff. So, I covered you know, a lot of the schools in the Los Angeles area. So it's, you know, I'll still run into guys, you know, players from that I knew back when they were in college, and they're like, "Oh my God, what are you doing here?" You know, that kind of thing. And it's nice to see that. It's definitely nice to see some of those guys really succeed. Guys like Troy Tulowitzki, Evan Longoria, Jared Weaver, all out of Long Beach State.
Yeah, I was going to say Long Beach State, Big West guys.
Yeah, a lot of really good, really good players there in a kind of a period from about pretty much the time I was out there covering the team from about 04 to 08. They really produced a bumper crop of big leaguers just out of that school. And, you know, I saw a few from Cal State Fullerton, like Kurt Suzuki and Ricky Romero.
Sure.
And then not too many out of Pepperdine guys who've had trouble sticking around, like Barry Enright, Danny Worth, those kind of guys.
Right. The West Coast Conference isn't quite as strong probably as the Big West in general, right?
Yeah. I mean, the West Coast Conference kind of faces, you know, you have that, you got to get a certain kind of kid in there because those schools are all private.
Right.
They're very expensive. They have very high academic standards. So they oftentimes have, it's kind of the same issue that tends to plague USC in baseball these days. You're kind of recruiting from a somewhat limited base.
Sure.
You can't recruit the way Long Beach and Fullerton can, where they can go to any part of Southern California and pretty much get out of there and say, here's a partial scholarship. You know, it's pretty cheap. Your family should handle the best.
Right, right. And I think, you know, as far as Cal Poly goes, just academically, it's something that they struggle with sometimes as far as finding, I guess, the right kid in the same way that, at least academically, like a USC or, you know, some of those other schools might be thinking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
Tell me what's the, just real quick, since you did cover baseball and sports down in Southern California, what was in your estimation, the perception of Cal Poly? Because for a lot of people, it's kind of an unknown, you know, in the Big West, people who are from LA don't have a great picture for exactly where it is. Is it by Santa Barbara? Is it north of, you know, San Luis Obispo is kind of an enigma for a lot of people. What was the perception, at least in your mind, when you were down there?
I think because Cal Poly came down and, you know, and they played a lot of the schools in midweek games, I recall, I don't remember if it was 05 or 06, but, you know, Cal Poly opened. They had a pretty good pitching staff that year, projected to have a good one. And they were playing UCLA, and I think it was John Savage's first season at the helm of the Bruins, so it was considered a pretty good preseason matchup, you know.
Right.
I think in general, because, you know, they've played Fullerton tough, they played Long Beach tough. I think the general perception is that, you know, at least in baseball, that they have a quality program. The perception is probably also that this, you know, it's hard to recruit to Tampa Bay Obispo. It's, you know, versus recruiting the kid to you know, Westchester, Florida, or Marymount, or to Long Beach, or to Fullerton, or to Irvine, and
exactly.
West. And so on and so forth. So
right.
I think there's, you know, there's always maybe that little bit of that perception of, oh, there are a bunch of farm kids up there chewing on hay and that kind of stuff. But I never really thought, you know, there you didn't get any sense of like animosity or anything like that. You know, there's no real, there wasn't necessarily a rivalry. I think there was a respect. There wasn't,
sure.
But, you know, it wasn't like people were circling their calendars the way they do in the sports on beach and,
sure.
Yes, he played Dylan and those sort of things.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And this year in basketball, I think it's interesting. Cal Poly is going to the UCLA regional. And in basketball, they went into Poly Pavilion this year and beat UCLA. And so it'll be, you know, the first, maybe one of the first teams back there. Since then, I think it'll be kind of an interesting, I don't know if that has anything to do with the storyline for baseball, but for people from San Luis, that, you know, there's a good taste in their mouth, I guess, from the last time the Mustangs were down in Westwood. We'll switch gears quickly and go from one of my favorite topics, Cal Poly, to my other favorite topic, which is the Dodgers. And the Isotopes, of course, are the Dodgers AAA franchise in Albuquerque. The Dodgers actually have a lot of history in Albuquerque. And being that you're from there, I'm going to ask you to kind of break down the timeline. I know that the Albuquerque Dukes were the Dodgers AAA team for a lot of years.
It goes back even further than that. The old Albuquerque Dukes, we're talking back in the 1950s, they used to play at Tingley Field. And today, Tingley Field is located right next to where the zoo is. So it's in downtown. It's in the Burles neighborhood.
Okay.
It was now it's like youth softball complex kind of place, Little League fields and stuff. But they used to play way down there, and they were a Dodgers affiliate.
Okay.
They played in the Texas League. So they were actually, you know, in the Texas League with like Midland and San Antonio and those types of teams.
In West Texas, even more fun, yeah.
Sorry, the dog's barking.
That's okay.
I'm going to make her be quiet.
What kind of dog do you have?
She's just an older dog, and she gets spooked. I think it's actually the flag outside. She's barking at the flag.
Yeah, it gets pretty windy out there. I spent some time for work in Albuquerque and Gallup, and that wind blows through there.
Yeah, but anyway, back to the Dukes and they're kind of known as the Albuquerque Dodgers. They actually dropped the Dukes name in the '60s, and then. You know, the Tingley Field was old, it was outdated, it was, you know, surrounded, you couldn't do any expansion because you had a whole neighborhood around it, you had the zoo next to it. So they decided to build the Albuquerque Sports Stadium, and they basically kind of bought or leased the land from the University of New Mexico.
Okay.
So they ended up on this, it's at the intersection of University and what is today Cesar Chavez Boulevard. It used to be Stadium Boulevard. So it sits on the northeast corner. On the southeast corner is the UNM football stadium.
Okay.
And the southwest corner is the pit.
Right. Okay.
And so it was kind of convenient that they put all three, you know, major sports facilities in the same place.
Right.
And the Dodgers moved their AAA team to Albuquerque in 1972. And the manager of that team was Tommy Lasorda.
Tommy Lasorda, exactly. Right.
Yeah, and so very quickly, because of Tommy and because of the team's instant success, they won the Pacific Coast League title their first year here in town. They became a major draw, you know.
Right.
They continued with that, you know, up to when I got here in the 1980s. And, you know, essentially you had three sports seasons. You had Lobo football in the fall, you had basketball in the winter into the spring, and then you had the Dukes for the late spring and into the summer. And, you know, we saw tons of great players come through here. I mean, I think all the Dodgers, when they had that string of rookies of the year in the 90s.
Karros, Mondesi.
Yeah, Karros, Mondesi, Piazza, Hollinsworth.
Noma.
The only one who didn't come here. Yeah, Noma skipped here.
Right.
They had Noma made like, he made like five starts at AA, and then he goes straight up to the big leagues.
Got it.
So,
he was also a little older, right?
What's that?
I said he was also a little older, I think, by the time he got to the majors. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was younger than some of the Japanese guys are now. But yeah, I think he was like 25 or 26.
Right.
Which is older than most. Yeah. Certainly older than like Piazza was when he came through here.
Sure. Sorry to interrupt.
But we saw a lot of great players come through here. You know, the team's always had a lot of success in Albuquerque. And so, you know, back in those days, you know, that was before Phoenix had any teams. You know, for football, people were usually Cowboys or Broncos, but, you know, those two teams have been here for a long time. But otherwise, for baseball, we were Dodger fans. And for basketball, you know, pretty much everybody's a Lakers fan, especially because Michael Cooper, who played here at UNM, went on to play for the Lakers.
Got it. Yeah.
So there was a lot of that connection between, you know, Albuquerque and Los Angeles. And I think in the end, you know, the unfortunate thing was the stadium decayed. New stadiums were being built throughout the league, and they just sort of ran into a big political boondoggle, you know, can we upgrade it, can we not? And they essentially, I think there was a belief here that, you know, the Dukes will never leave. But they did. Mm-hmm. They did. They were sold to a group who moved them to Portland, Oregon. And for 2 years, there was no baseball here. I was in Tucson at the time, so I kind of missed, like, the overall impact. But it was still strange to, you know, come back for the weekend in the summertime, visit the family, and, you know, used to be my dad and I go to Duke's game.
Right, right.
And then all of a sudden it's like, you know, what else is there to do in Albuquerque in the summer? It's like, oh, dear, this town's kind of dull.
Interesting.
But kind of what happened was this this one investor, he sort of saw the Albuquerque market, and he looked at the attendance figures, and he's like, they didn't leave because of bad attendance, you know.
Right.
They just missed because the stadium wasn't up to par. And so he teamed up with a couple other people, one of whom was Ken Young. And they got together and said, let's figure out a way to get a team back into Albuquerque. And so, you know, they looked at the team that they were struggling attendance-wise in the league, and one of them was Calgary. And so they ended up, they worked out a deal where all they did was they took the same spot in the sports stadium is. They left the field, and they left the outfield light poles, and everything else they redid. And they tore everything to the ground and rebuilt it.
They left the light poles. And, I love it.
Yeah. And so then they built this huge new stadium, just gorgeous, state-of-the-art. And they moved the Calgary Cannons down here, and they opened it to the fans because the group who moved the team to Portland said, we own the Duke's moniker. You can have it for like $1 million.
Oh, man. So that was a question I was going to ask. Yeah.
These guys were just like, no. Sorry.
No.
They just said, let's give the team a new name. It's a new team. It's a new stadium. Let's be new.
Sure.
And at Pierce State, they had several suggestions, all kind of tied to the Southwest and stuff. And then they went online, and they did an online poll. And somebody somewhere on the line remembered the episode of The Simpsons where the mayor of Albuquerque was trying to steal the Springfield isotopes, and Homer went on the hunger strike to stop them. And they put isotopes as one of the choices. And I think isotopes ended up with like 70% of the votes online. And this is at like 8 different names. And one got 70% of the vote. So they said, all right, we're the isotopes.
Done. Yeah, absolutely.
It also tied into, of course, you know, you can also say it ties into Mexico's history with the nuclear weapons program with Los Alamos, Sandia National Labs, which is right here in town, you know, Trinity sites, Oppenheimer, all of that.
It makes a ton of sense. Yeah.
Yeah, it sort of makes double sense in that, yes, it is a Simpsons pop culture reference, but it also ties into the sort of the nuclear industry in this state. And so the isotopes were born, and, you know, since they've been in existence, they've finished in the top 3 in attendance every year. You know, they've definitely got great local support, but, you know, I come back here in the summer, and you could tell everyone was enjoying themselves, but there wasn't an attachment to the team because they were a Marlins affiliate. And, you know, most of the guys who were helping the Marlins out were skipping from AA. You know, Dontrell Willis and Miguel Cabrera never came to Albuquerque.
Interesting. Okay.
The most
and this is like player, and this is like the early part of the 2000s now, is that?
Yeah. So we're talking 2003.
Okay.
They got here in 2003, which is actually the year the Marlins, you know, pulled the upsets and won the World Series.
And they lost but, and they lost the Dukes in what, like 95 or something?
19. No, it was the last season of the Dukes of 2000.
2000.
So
okay.
It seemed like an eternity.
Right.
But it was really only 2 seasons without baseball.
So let me get this straight real quick. The Dodgers moved their affiliation when the Dukes moved to Portland. The Dodgers moved their affiliation to Las Vegas at that point. Right. So
yeah.
They were never in Portland. It was just the Dukes owners essentially moved whatever that franchise was to.
Right.
Okay.
Portland. Yeah, it's something that fans always, it's sometimes like they have a trouble. You know, the Dodgers now, no more than the Marlins, then they don't own the isotopes. They're just affiliated with them. It's an affiliation agreement where the team provides the players and the manager and the coaches.
Right.
And then the team runs the stadium and the concessions and everything else.
Great.
The isotopes, they came into existence. They were Marlins fan club. Adrian Gonzalez was probably the most successful player to play here. And he was here for about 20 games. And then he got traded by the Marlins, Texas. I think he got traded in the Ugreth or Bina deal.
Interesting.
And of course, later, Texas traded him to San Diego, and that's where he finally got the chance to play and blossom into an all-star.
Right, right.
For the most part, it was just kind of a constant, we'll call a veteran, AAA journeyman. Dallas McPherson played here. Val Pascucci played here. Chris Ashby. Guys who probably popped up in a half a dozen or more AAA cities were just, that was the makeup of the team. I think the perception was always the Marlins didn't want their pitchers to come here and get exposed to the altitude and that sort of thing.
And to the Pacific Coast League, right? I mean, mentality that goes along with that.
Yeah. And so finally, after the 2008 season, the affiliation agreements all kind of expired. And as much as the Dodgers, I think, like the proximity of Las Vegas, the facilities in Las Vegas are pretty terrible. Cashman Field's one of the older stadiums in the league. Nobody can get any money to ever upgrade it because the belief is still there that they could come to get a major league team. So it's like, why upgrade the minor league park?
Okay.
So the Dodgers were looking for a much better facility, and I think they recognized, we've got a huge fan base in Albuquerque. Let's go back to Albuquerque, and we'll see how we adjust to pitching there because, they sent their pitchers to Vegas. Kind of the unfortunate thing was by about the time that the Dodgers got here, where Frank McCourt was pinching his pennies started to become apparent, which was in the farm system. He was
the minor league system. Exactly.
Yeah. He was ignored Latin America almost completely. So he wasn't signing kids out of the Dominican or Venezuela or any of those other countries. And in the draft, they were mostly just signing guys who, signed for slot. They weren't extending. The only time I think they ever extended their bonus money was for Zach Lee.
Okay.
And so for the most part, even though the Dodgers moved in here, you weren't seeing necessarily, elite prospects. The guys like Matt Kemp and Clayton Kershaw had already moved up to the big leagues by the time the Dodgers got here. So.
Well, and they did a lot of their damage at Double A anyway, like I think in Jacksonville or somewhere, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so most of those guys only stopped in Las Vegas for like a month, and then they were in L.A.
Right.
So for the most part, it was still kind of a lot of veterans. Guys like John Lindsay played here. He was a very popular player, just such a nice guy.
Right.
And, lots of other ones. Guys who kind of seen as sort of that fringy guy, like a Blake DeWitt. He was here for a while.
Uh-huh.
Bouncing back and forth, on the plane. And, but I think, more recently we started with a few more prospects emerging. The Dodgers have been sending them here. And this season, of course, they put in a humidor. try and help the pitching a little bit. So I think that's a big part of the reason you got guys here now like Matt McGill and Chris Withrow and Steve Ames, instead of
got
protecting
it.
Them. Then, yeah.
Has the humidor made a difference, and do they use it in other parks, like in Colorado Springs and other places?
Colorado Springs is the only other TCL team to use it so far.
And Colorado Springs is higher altitude than Denver. It's like 6,000 feet, so
yeah.
I'd imagine that thing's just like a circus.
It's the highest in the U.S. Colorado Springs, the first year that they didn't have it, to the year they did, their ERA dropped by almost a run and a half.
That's ridiculous.
And their home run total and the outs dropped. But as somebody pointed out to me, he said, yeah, you could say that was all the humidor, but do we also know if they had better pitching?
Right.
He said it's hard to tell. He said it's one of these things where you're not going to really be able to know until maybe 3 or 4 years down the line.
Got it.
If numbers are really changing. I think there are still nights here where a good hitter is going to hit the ball out no matter what.
Got it.
But I think in the wind conditions here can be crazy enough. I saw Alex Castellanos kill a baseball this year. I mean, he absolutely murdered it, and that thing died on the warning track. It's just like it hit a wall of wind and just fell straight down and actually caused the left fielder to have to come back in.
So he even had a bad beat on the ball. He was going all the way to the wall and had to take a couple steps in. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it can get bad. We have those moments of wackiness, especially in April. It tends to die down during May, but tonight it's picking back up again. So
got it. And
I have told every player who's ever played here, whatever you think about New Mexico weather, and you start to think I know what it's going to be tomorrow, you're wrong.
Yeah, good luck, right? I know when I used to talk to a few friends of mine who lived out in Gallup, and they would, it'd be sunny one day and snowing the next, and they never really knew what was going on out there. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, we had an exhibition game once between the Rockies and the Mariners here, and it literally was snowing as we were supposed to talk to some of the players in the field, so we all went inside, and we were talking to the Rockies players, and they're like, well, this is getting us ready for Denver, and then we finished with them, and we're walking across to go over to talk to the Mariners, and all of a sudden the sun just comes out, and the Mariners are just like, we'll talk to you on the field.
Yeah.
This was like literally 20 minutes. It went from snowing, windy and cold to bright and sunny.
That's fantastic. So, you talked a lot about the Dodger fans there. Do you guys get Dodger games on your local TV? Is there any kind of connection that way? Or are technically you guys like in the Diamondbacks or the Rockies media market? What does that look like?
We are like half Rockies, half Diamondbacks. We actually... if you have like digital cable, you get both Fox Sports Arizona and Root Sports Rocky Mountain.
So you'll get both of them.
You get both. We don't get the Dodgers on TV. We do have Dodgers games here on the radio.
Okay.
That still happens here. I've always felt that. Yeah, honestly, if they ever switched us over to Fox Sports Prime Ticket, they would probably get higher viewing than they do for either Fox Sports Arizona or Root.
But when you start talking about chopped up media markets, now that with the expansion and the Diamondbacks and the Rockies coming into play, it's a really interesting thing and kind of micromanaging some of the media markets too. In San Luis Obispo here, we're literally halfway between LA and San Francisco. And growing up in the 80s, we always had KCAL on our cable, and KCAL was great to watch the Dodgers and the Lakers, and Prime Ticket when it first came out was a great, way to catch the Lakers as well. And now if you get Dish and you live here, you don't get KCAL. And so the games are blacked out. You literally can't watch the KCAL games unless you have a cable package through Charter. If you have DirecTV, there's literally no way for you to watch the game, because if you bought the MLB package, it would be blacked out. And KCAL doesn't, we can't get KCAL on DirecTV because we're told that we're out of the media market for KCAL. So it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, we at the Isotopes ballpark, they have DirecTV on the TV in the press box. And so a lot of times we put the Dodgers games on, and every now and again we click on the Dodger game and it would just say, like, the channel's blacked out in your area, and we look at the schedule and be like, oh, they're playing the Rockies, they're playing the Diamondbacks. They would actually black us out on DirecTV on both. And it wouldn't even be that, if the Rockies or Diamondbacks are playing them in Los Angeles, you would get the Rockies or D-backs seat.
Sure.
But if you're playing them at home, you'd get totally blacked out because the games weren't selling out. Diamondbacks games never sell out.
Right.
It's just Phoenix is too apathetic toward everything.
But what is that, about an 8 or 9 hour drive from Albuquerque?
Phoenix is... You can probably get Phoenix from here in about 7 hours.
Okay.
Denver's probably about six. It's not too far. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
Denver's nice because it's just straight up 25. With Phoenix, you can either take sort of the back way, or you just take 40 to Flagstaff and then south on 17.
Got it. Yeah, it's just you just have to hop in your car and drive for 7 hours, and then you can watch the game. Darn it.
Pretty much. Yeah.
I've always thought that for those places, kind of in MLB no man's land, you should just get what you know. Nothing should be blacked out. I think. When you're over like I don't know, 3 or 4 hours away, I think at that point.
I think if you're in another state, you're pretty. You know, you should be pretty well excluded from.
If there's no baseball in your state, yeah. Or I mean, even West Texas. I mean, to get to Dallas, You know, could be like a 10-hour drive. Who knows? So that's interesting. You know, I always liked the Dukes. I was looking it up, like minor league hats that you could buy, and I think maybe the Dukes or the Isotopes or both will be my next hat choice. I have so many blue LA hats. I think I'm gonna go with maybe a Dukes hat or an Isotopes hat. I think they're both pretty cool logos. Yeah. In the minor leagues, things like promotions and logos and how communities feel about teams make a big difference. What's the best? I mean, I don't think do you travel with the Isotopes? Not really.
No, okay. I don't travel with them. I don't think there's a single writer in the country who travels with a minor league team.
Okay, that was a dumb question, but
it's entirely possible people used to.
Yeah,
and I'm sure back in the days, you know, I've talked to guys here at the Albuquerque Journal, and they're telling me that, oh, back in the day, we used to go up and cover every Broncos home game. I'm like, you're kidding, really? You drove to Denver to cover every Broncos home game? That's an amazing waste of money.
But papers could do that back then.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, you know, you talk to the old-time staffers, like when I was in Los Angeles, and I talked to some of the old-time people at the LA Times, and they tell you about the good old days. And, it really sounded like, other than the lack of, you know, good technology in the newsroom, you know, when it came to typewriter and all the old-school stuff they had to do to make the newspaper work, everything else was pretty cool in terms of, like, the travel and the expense reports you could fill out and all this stuff. I think, just going back to what you said about the Isotopes and the logo and everything, I know they've been near the top of the minors in merchandise sales for quite some time.
Yeah, and I think the Simpsons connection is really cool. What's the best, like, promotion you've seen in the minor leagues in the time that you've covered the Isotopes? Like, minor league teams are like, kind of known sometimes for, you know, come shave your head, you know, let us shave your head and we'll let you in for free. Or do you have a tattoo or something?
I don't know if I've ever seen like kind of a really outrageous one with the Isotopes. I remember for the Dukes back in the day, one guy said they really should bring it back. There was Bowling for Gas or something, and they were literally like some gas station was sponsored this thing where you took like a bocce ball or something, and you had to roll it across the grass, and you know they had like a sign shaped like a car, and they had like the little holes where the wheels are.
Okay.
And if you rolled it through there, you got like free gas for a month or something like that. It was just this old promotion they used to do with the Dukes, and somebody was like, how can they not bring that back? That would be so popular these days without the expensive gas. And I said, you just answered your own question. But I always, you know, there were lots of little ones like that. But I think even as a kid, I wasn't paying attention to the promotions. You know, I wasn't the kid who wanted to go out and, run around and eat ice cream and that kind of stuff. I was actually the kid who would sit there and tell you, like, you know, that guy's a really good player, but he's blocked by so-and-so. Uh-huh. He should get traded, hopefully, and that kind of
thing. Like, yeah.
I was the sports geek long before I, you know, got my journalism degree and marched off into the world of professional writing.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that. I kind of get that feeling about Albuquerque in general. What you just described is that, you know, the gimmicky stuff, while it's good and well, you know, that's not maybe what the thing about the Isotopes or the baseball is there. It's a real kind of, I don't want to say old school, but older school, I guess, as far as allegiance goes and probably the fan base. Is that something that's accurate?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think, you know, it's just like I said, you know, in this town, you know, we're not, you know, we don't have a big theme park here. We don't have, you know, I mean, we got some events like the stay fair and those sorts of things. But really, for a lot of people, this town was always defined by the three seasons, you know, college football, college basketball, and minor league baseball. Yeah. And I think it just it bred a lot of loyalty into people.
Sure. It's a blue-collar town, know, too, right?
Yeah, I'd say for the most part, it's you know, people here sort of view this as a blue-collar town. You know, it's a military town. You kind of have a fair number of transitional, you know, transitory population. But you got a lot of ex-military that have generally settled here, like my dad.
Got
and
it.
My grandfather before him. Uh-huh. And, you know, so I think there's sort of a sense of loyalty to the local team. And, you know, maybe, you know, some people argue it's not as strong with the Aztecs as it was with the Dukes. But I think, you know, in general, like any sports town or any town period, you know, people like to find things to complain about. they've been complaining, you know, you should have seen the amount of complaints that came about when essentially the University of New Mexico on its own, they own most of the parking lots around the stadium. They just decided, like, a week before the season to start charging for parking. You know, for the longest time, I started parking was free.
Yeah.
And this actually really soured the relationship between the university and the Aztecs.
Oh, interesting.
There is no love lost between the UNM athletic department and the Aztecs management. And so
does
you know,
UNM
the amount of people complaining. Yeah, but just you know, oh, how dare you charge for parking? I'm not going to go to your games anymore. And so I think everyone kind of waited, you know, with a sort of, you know, a little bit of bated breath, like, oh, is the attendance really going to go down? Is it really going to suffer? No, it didn't.
No, it's just a few people being...
Just a few vocal people who are complaining, but, you know, the rule still is you have four or more people in your car, you get in for free. So I think it just, if nothing else, maybe it just encouraged the carpooling.
There you go, yeah.
You know, it wasn't a big thing, but then more recently they had a, you know, minor league baseball released a study, like, what are the average prices for tickets and hot dogs and soda and beer and everything else at the ballpark. And Albuquerque came out on the higher end where most of their prices are a little higher than the AAA average. And so, again, you got a bunch of people complaining and moaning and groaning about, oh, you know, it's just too expensive for them. And I'm sorry, Los Angeles for 5 years. I laugh at any time anyone says anything in Albuquerque is expensive. I paid $950 a month for a studio.
Right, exactly. And you could get you can get a palace in Albuquerque probably, you know, to rent for that much. It's
I mean, honestly, you know, you'd be like, oh, I'm not going to spend like $6 for a beer, and I'm like, go to LA, you get cheap beer.
For ten, yeah, exactly. Yeah, go to Dodger Stadium and see what happens. Yeah.
Yeah, and enjoy the $15 parking at Dodger Stadium.
Right, sure. And
the hours it's gonna take you to get out of Chavez Ravine.
And on top of that, you know, you have a brand new park, so it's an interesting thing there too, where they gotta pay for, you know, for the park that they have. Not that that's what parking does, but for the other things. I want to ask you about players for a second, and players, I don't want to say they're kind of secondary at AAA, but man, the Dodgers have just been destroyed by injuries this year. I think they've had 14, I don't know what the number is now, maybe it's 15 now, players go on the DL or have DL stints this year. The webmaster, I don't know, do they still have webmaster? Is that still like a title? Whoever that is for the Isotopes who puts their roster together, must be the busiest guy in baseball. Because every time I look on it, you know, it's a little different because guys are getting sent up and called down or sent down and called up. D. Gordon, I saw, got sent back down today. Jerry Hairston came off the DL. What does that do to the team in Albuquerque? Does it have like a ripple effect through different levels? Like, when D. Gordon comes back to the Isotopes, does somebody else get sent down to AA or release? You know, what is that? What's that like as far as the roster goes, and as far as the fans go too? I mean, the fans are excited to see somebody go or excited to see somebody come back at some level. What does that do?
I think, you know, the fans are interesting because you really have, you know, I've always said there's three types of fans here. There's the fan that goes there because it's free T-shirt night. It's fireworks night. They're really only concerned with going to the ballpark. They'll watch the game, but they're not invested in it.
It's more the promotion thing.
They're the people who buy individual game tickets.
Right.
Then you might have the person who gets, like, the partial season ticket plan or something, or they buy a lot of individual tickets over the course of the year. They want the Ice Tips to win the game. But, you know, they recognize the fact that, who's that at first base? I don't know. Okay, well, whatever. I hope he does well. and then you kind of have that third fan who's sort of, you know, the more diehard fan. Usually they're typically people who are Dodger fans.
Right.
And they... you know, so they're invested, but they're obviously a lot more invested in a Deagle and a Tim Fedorovich than they're going to be in, you know, Rusty Ryle or, you know, Blake Johnson or Matt Engel.
What a great name, Rusty Ryle.
Yes. Anyway, so, you know, I think the way, you know, fans recognize Triple A for what it is. You know, it's a minor league. You know, guys are going to come and go. I definitely think there are certain players, you know, fans do get an attachment to. They do come to like some of them. I think the main thing they just want from the players is, you know, go out, play the game, and behave yourselves. And the one thing that is good about the Dodgers, you know, even from my standpoint when it comes to interviewing guys, they really have assembled a group of, you know, maybe they're not the most talented players in the world, maybe they're not all future All-Stars, but they're good guys.
Right.
You know, they really are genuinely good character. I think character is something that, you know, we're in an age of where everything can be statistically quantified.
Uh-huh.
And I think just being a good person and good character and everything else, that's not necessarily, for some teams it's not that important, but for the Ice, you know, for the Dodgers, you know, the guys I've encountered with the Ice teams, by and large, they're good people. And because of that, you know, they're not out getting drunk and getting in fights with their spouses or girlfriends. You know, they're not brawling with people at the bar or something like that. They're, you know, they behave themselves off the field. And I think that's all everybody in this town wants. You know, you play the game right and you be respectful to everybody off the field. That's cool. You know, you don't see players like chirping up about, you know, oh, Albuquerque's so boring. Oh, what do you do here at night? You know,
right.
They're smart enough and they're savvy enough to know, you know, don't badmouth the place where you're playing.
Right.
Yeah, I know, you know, no, it's not where you want your final destination to be, but at the same time, they're smart enough to recognize, you know, sort of that need for fan support and everything else.
So I want to jump in and ask you about that, because there's a guy that you mentioned already who kind of comes to mind when it comes to that character part of things. And I was at spring training for one game this year, so got to cover, you know, the team for just the day that I was there. But one guy who kind of struck me, you know, and kind of his approach and how he, kind of handles himself is Alex Castellanos. As a guy who, like you said, kind of may not put up like ridiculous numbers sometimes, but puts up kind of solid numbers and seems like kind of a character kind of guy. Tell me, and other Dodger fans who may be listening, a little bit. I know Alex has had some time in the majors, but what's he like, and is he one of those guys? And if not him, who are some other guys too who are some of those guys who stand out as far as the character part goes?
Oh man, Alex is a nice kid. He's he does kind of strike you as younger, you know, in terms of his personality. I think a lot of that comes from the fact, yeah, you know, some guys can be the same age as him, maybe even a year or two younger, but maybe you think they're more mature because they're married and they got kids and that sort of stuff. You know, Alex is—he's a single guy, so far as I know.
Uh-huh.
I don't think he got married at Boston. I didn't ask players too much about their personal lives.
Sure, sure.
He's kind of—you know—he's smiling. He's carefree. And, you know, during batting practice and everything, it's kind of when you tend to see the personalities of these guys kind of come out. You know, but he's serious about the game. I mean, that's the thing. They all, you know, they all know when to flip the switch.
Sure.
And be a professional baseball player versus just being one of the guys. But, you know, Alex, it's kind of funny because, you know, he seems so laid back, kind of like this laid back dude you'd expect to, you know, hang out with at a bar by the beach in Miami, which
uh-huh.
is where he's from.
Uh-huh.
But it's funny because during games, he plays a lot of intensity, and sometimes it gets the better of him. You know, he'll start getting closer to the plate, he'll chase some pitches and stuff. And the other night, I've seen him before where he gets frustrated after he strikes out, and he's frustrated with himself.
Right.
he'll throw something on the ground, and the umpire will just kind of look at him for a minute and be like, "Nah, I don't care." The other night, he kind of tossed his bat away, and then he slammed his helmet down out of frustration,
uh-huh.
and the umpire ejected.
Uh-huh.
And after the game, one of the other players was pointing out to him, they're like, "Alex, don't you remember what he said? He said, as long as you only throw one thing, he won't eject you. You throw your helmet and you, like that." And Castellanos is serious. Tim Fedorovich is telling Castellanos, and Alex is just looking at him like, "Oh, I wasn't paying attention when he said that." And Fed's just shaking his head. Just shaking his head at Alex. You know, so... Yeah, he kind of has those baseball player moments. I think all the players do, even the really intelligent guys will sometimes have those moments when you kind of remember that, yeah, these are grown men, but they're still playing a kid's game, and sometimes they're like kids out there.
Well, yeah, and that just kind of blows my mind, like the idea, because you know that, the minor league manager files reports and that kind of stuff, gets in those reports or whatever, people know, Ned Colletti and his staff, they know what is happening in the minors. They know that, they know that Castellanos is getting kicked out of a AAA game for throwing two things instead of one. What the hell, I think about things like that, and okay, that's why we haven't seen Alex Castellanos, in LA sooner. That's why he hasn't been given, that's why there's guys like, Skip Schumacher around, or, some of the other, outfielders, for instance, who are kind of journeymen. I mean, you look at a Castellanos or a Herrera or guys like that, and you wonder, okay, Herrera plays all the same positions, I think, as Schumacher. Why hasn't he stuck? I mean, these are kinds of questions that I ask myself, and I think he's still relatively young, but he's, for a baseball player, he should be, starting to make that progress, I guess, if you're a Dodger fan and looking at it.
I think there's a lot of that stuff, and this is just my perception of the Dodgers in general under Ned Colletti. Ned was raised in the old San Francisco Giants system,
uh-huh.
and, when Ned was still with the Giants were a veteran team.
Yep.
They, young players who came up with the Giants were traded for more veterans.
Yeah.
The Giants really didn't start going into sort of a youth movement until they started getting these incredible players, Lindskum, Canton, Posey, within their own system. They're like, wait, this guy's too good. We're not trading away.
Right.
And they changed course. The Giants are definitely, it's evolved that way. They went from the Barry Bonds years of surviving veterans to past the veterans to
right.
where they're trying to build through the farm system.
Right.
And I think, unfortunately, when it comes to roster construction, the 35-year-old guy with years of experience under his belt, yeah, he may be a little more injury-prone. Yeah, his bat may have slowed a bit, but Ned trusts him than the 25 kid with yeah. upside that's still in the raw around the edges. So yeah. I think that in general. I don't think it's needed. They feel like Alex or Elian or any of the players, I don't think they just think, oh, he's not mature enough to do that.
Right.
They might think that with a guy like Puig.
we'll come to him in a second. Yeah.
yeah. And, but I think for the most part, it's just a preference. You look back to the history of their signings and their dealings, they have long preferred to turn to a veteran than to really to bring a kid up.
Uh-huh.
It's a strange thing because it kind of bucks the trend in today's game.
It bucks the trend. It bucks the trend, but it also seems kind of counter. I don't know. I always kind of bottom line it as far as what have they gotten out of it? And well, they made the playoffs a couple years in a row, and I was at the first game they won in the Phillies series, the year they were in the NLCS. I think it was the first NLCS game that they've won since '88. But you even got the feeling during that game, I think it was game three, and it put them at down 2-1. Even in that series, you never really got the impression, I don't know, I mean, maybe it's just my negative kind of outlook on the whole McCourt regime, but I never really felt like that team even was going to, seriously challenge the Phillies. I would have been, really pleasantly surprised had those Dodgers, who had Blake DeWitt starting at third base, and who had, kind of riding the Manny Ramirez train. I never really even felt like they had a serious shot. So I guess, my question is always, okay, well, if you're if you're not really, you know, looking like things are going to, you know, work out, and this year I would say would be an exception at the beginning of the year, you know, where the Dodgers had high expectations, you know, why not, when given the choice between, you know, this guy or this guy, why not try the younger guy with more upside who may surprise you or he may not, and then you at least you know, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, we've seen, I think that is a major sticking point for most people with Coletti, is that, you know, he's kind of stubborn in one way, and he tends to run certain guys out there, you know, past their usefulness date. I mean, you know, everyone right now is pointing to Luis. Perfectly good guy, actually, really, really class human being. But let's face it, Luis Cruz can't hit the broadside of a barn right now.
Right now, yeah.
And so it's just one of these things, like, why is he still on the roster? And, you know, why is there Castellanos down here? I mean, in Alex's case, just individually, he has a really bad habit of getting hurt at the absolute wrong time.
Yeah, I was looking at that for the last few years. He's been injured.
Last year, hamstring injury, and then this year, the forearm was kind of barking at him.
Yeah.
And it was just right at that time. I mean, cause I think, honestly, he would have gone up before Van Slyke because, you know, Alex is still in the 40 men. And another Coletti trait, of course, is to keep as many players as you can. You know, it's a big thing for him. He hates designating guys for assignment and risking losing players.
So the DL guys, you know, and do things like that. And I don't want to make I don't want to make it a Ned Coletti bashing. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, Paul Di Podesta probably got bashed too much, and that, you know, I think, you know, when you go back to ownership versus GMs.
Yeah, it's tough to separate, you know, the owner's money from the GM's decisions.
Right.
And then sometimes, you know, there's a lot of people who say that's a really good decision, and it still blows up in your face because it still comes down to the players themselves and what they are capable of doing or not doing. You know, everyone had very high hopes for Jerry Sands. It didn't pan out for him.
Right.
It's unfortunate. But it never really panned out for him, and now, you know, he's with the Pirates, and I don't even think he's hitting 200 at AAA right now.
Yeah, exactly. So, and so that trade looks great, I mean, at this point, as far as the Sands part of it, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
you know, honestly, that's what it is, though. Baseball is a weird sport, you know. It's so unpredictable. It really is incredibly unpredictable. You know, I've talked to guys here who've been out to a few games, like, I thought that one guy, somebody mentioned Russ Mitchell the other day. Like, I thought Russ Mitchell was going to make it. I thought he was at least going to be a back bench player in the big leagues.
Right.
You know, Russ Mitchell's out of a job right now. I don't think he's playing anywhere. I think he was at spring training with the Rockies and didn't make any of their rosters, and, you know, now he's out of a job. You know, Russ Mitchell probably isn't old yet. You know, if he is, he's just turned 30.
I always thought that about Joe Thurston, too, who was a second baseman in the Dodgers organization. Yeah. You know, he was always hitting 330 at AAA. It seemed like for 5 or 10 years, the dude was just like, you know, he'd come up at the end of the year, he'd get a few at-bats. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a left-handed hitting second baseman, which is, you know, with a tiny bit of pop and some, you know, some speed or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, again, just one of those things where, you know, when he did get his chances at the major league level, never really made a huge impact, and so kept getting kind of sent back and forth.
Guys don't get chances for years, and then suddenly they get one. Next thing you know, you're AJ Ellis.
Right.
You know, he was a good defensive catcher who walked a lot. That was AJ Ellis down here. And then AJ Ellis goes to the big leagues, and everybody's like, oh, God, are we really going to start AJ Ellis? No. So he's kind of good.
Yeah.
He's actually like really good now,
and seemed like he was one of the guys who I did get to talk to in spring training, and just seemed like one of the nicest guys. I talked to, you know, both Ellis's on the Dodgers. I feel like are just, you know, super professional, super nice guys. As far as, you know, when the 10 minutes I spent with each of them.
My AJ story from this year: I was down at spring training, so I'm over in the clubhouse, and we kind of wrapped up all that before. So Dylan Hernandez and I are walking. You know, we walk down a little tunnel, so you go across the field for a little ways to go to the media room and grab something to eat.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I see out of the corner of my eye, one of the Dodgers is jogging over toward me, and it was AJ, and he just comes running over, shake my hand, ask me how I was doing and everything like that. And Dylan looks at him and goes, hey, you never do this for me. And AJ just looks straight at him and goes, I see you way too much during the year. I see Chris once.
I love it.
Yeah, he really is a great guy. He's got a terrific sense of humor and is really knows how to handle himself in the spotlight and everything else. And it's good to see, because you always wonder that, he's a really good guy in the minors. I wonder how he's going to be in the big leagues.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. Guys will go. I mean, when I met D. Gordon, he was the happy-go-lucky D. Gordon. And, yeah. He used to, yes, sir, no, sir, a lot of that in every interview. And then last year when he was down here towards the end of the season, they basically pushed his rehab stint as long as they could before they finally activated him.
Right.
He was surly. He was grumpy. He was blowing people off for interviews. You could tell he was frustrating the coaching staff because, it was his first experience of failure as a professional.
Yep.
And some of these guys, the hardest thing they have to deal with is that first struggle.
Yep.
That first point where they hit that wall and they can't break through it. Yeah. When people were asking me at the beginning of this year, is he? And I said, it's kind of quiet. But then after a little while, I started playing better, and he was back to happy D.
Right.
I have no idea what we're in for now that he's coming back down.
Should be interesting.
I hope he stays positive, but it's tough. He's young. He's rushed. I think anybody could tell you he was rushed to the big leagues because of her call. And in terms of his actual biological age versus his baseball age, he's much younger in baseball years.
Right. I can picture that.
Not like these guys who played little league and summer travel ball in high school and college and pro. Was a basketball player until he was like 16 or 17.
Till he realized he was 6 feet tall and not 6'8". Yeah, that's an interesting one. Like, they talk about Matt Kemp being a basketball player too or whatever, but he's 6'2", so you're talking about a guard, and there's a lot more really good 6'2" guys in the world than there are 6'8" guys. So unless you're pushing 6'5", there's kind of a cutoff there. It's an interesting thing in Southern California college basketball too, when you look at the Big West schools versus the there's a lot of really good 6 foot to 6'3" or 6'4" guys in the Big West. But, there aren't a lot of those, 6'8" guys. It's kind of an interesting dynamic. You talked about your moment with AJ Ellis and Dylan Hernandez, who I think are two of the most entertaining Twitter follows that you'll find. AJ's at his best when he's ripping on Kershaw, I always think. And Dylan, has a lot of great quips, and his hashtag for the Dodgers, Dr. Neil Ella Trash, I think that's how you pronounce it. I could be wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong, please. Is pretty funny. I always chuckle at that one. Do you have a Twitter handle? Are you social media? Are you on social media? Is there a Twitter handle that you want to give out?
Yeah. So. Yeah, Topes Rider.
Topes Rider.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, I like it.
On Twitter. I actually find that the majority of people who follow me on Twitter don't get fans. They're more interested in that sort of thing. So
yeah.
I think as a result, I guess part of the way I cover the team has changed a little bit in the sense that I tend to cover them more like Baseball America would or something like that, where I'm looking at, that they are the Dodgers farm club and that what's important here, the development of the players, wins and losses still matter, but, I don't tend to do as many of those like newspaper features where they talk about a guy, how he grew up and did this and did that. And, his favorite color is this and his, and he likes to take long walks on the beach and stuff like that.
Which might be fun for those season ticket holders, right? Who are really wanting to know about all the players on the team, and they want, those guys to be guys they can follow. But when you're thinking about it a little bit more globally, like you said, I mean, AlbuquerqueExaminer.com probably gets visited when it comes to sports, I would imagine, a lot from people in LA. I mean, that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. And I think just through social media and through Twitter and then just through interacting with, one of the blogs I interact with a lot, I've written for it too, is Mike Socia's Tragic Illness.
Yeah, with Mike, is it Petrelli?
I don't know.
What's that?
Petriello.
Petriello, sorry, yeah.
Pronouncing your name right, Mike. I'm sorry, I don't. It's Italian, I don't know.
Listen, if Mike listens to this podcast, I'll be stoked.
Right here.
Yeah.
our new media relations director here with the Isotopes, she pronounces her name, last name Barillo.
Uh-huh.
She's from New Jersey, and everyone out here is like, oh, bad eel. She's like, no.
I love it.
I'm Italian, not Spanish, you know. She's an Italian girl from Jersey. She's not descendant of the Spanish conquistadors living out here.
Awesome. There's another name that's kind of an interesting one to pronounce. It's Yasiel Puig, and he had one of the more amazing spring trainings that you'll ever see. Dylan Hernandez was, and Eric's, Steven, two of the guys who were, you know, just super high on him, and they were joking, you know, throughout spring training, and Dylan was asking them on a daily basis, you know, how are you guys going to, I think one of the questions was, you know, how are you guys going to send a guy like that down to the minors? And I think Mattingly's quip was, you know, usually we just tell him. He got sent down to double A. For you, is that kind of a disappointment that you don't get to see a guy like him? And is Chattanooga maybe a better choice for a player like him who is still kind of trying to assimilate, who I think has been arrested once, I think, this year already. He got arrested, right? I mean,
he's driving because how many miles over the speed limit, you know.
And then Zach Lee as well. Like, why isn't he at AAA?
Yeah. Well, I think in the case of a kid like Lee, you know, I understand if you don't want to put a kid here before he's 23 or 24. You know, Matt McGill is pretty young for AAA.
Okay.
To be honest.
Okay.
I think players proceeded a natural progression. And in Lee's case, he's where you could argue they may have rushed him a little bit last year when they moved him up to Chattanooga. The difficult thing with the Diamondbacks, of course, is you go from, let's say you get drafted and you're sent to Ogden. That's Utah, that's high desert, that's mountains, that's altitude and everything else.
Yeah.
Then you go to Great Lakes, and all of a sudden you're in humidity and low elevation and everything else. Then you're out to Rancho Cucamonga. Well, you know, people, that's nowhere near the ocean. That's dry, that's desert, that's windy.
Yep.
You know, the Cal League, the Gators League. Then you go to Chattanooga, and you're back to swampy and low elevation and all that. And
right.
Albuquerque. So I think for the Dodgers, it's always kind of a difficult, you know, where do we put our pitcher sort of thing. But in Lee's case, he's where he needs to be right now as far as double A goes. In Puig's case, Puig is just such an outlier. Again, I look at him and I compare him in some ways to Gordon in the sense that he has tremendous physical tools, you know.
Yep.
In these cases, it's speed. It's just ridiculous, game-changing.
Just speed. Raw speed.
But in terms of refinement, you know, Dee was never close to a finished product because he didn't have that baseball experience.
Sure.
In Puig's case, you know, he played in Cuba, but it's difficult to gauge really the quality of the Cuban league.
Yeah.
You know, versus the standard minor leagues. And then, of course, he had time off. You know, I think it was a year or two where he didn't play.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's a physical specimen. Yes, he can display a fastball. Yes, he can, if he's on target, he can throw out a base runner pretty easily.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, his maturity level is below that of an American player his age.
Right.
You know, his refinement as a baseball player is below that of a player, most players his age. Right now, he's tools. He's a big bag of tools. But no one's yet honed him into the player he needs to be. I personally thought before spring training started, he ended up at Rancho Cucamonga. But then he had the great spring, and I think that kind of forced their hand. And they said, all right, we're going to put him at Chattanooga. You know, he's going to face good pitching. He's going to face a challenging environment as far as hitting goes. They wanted to push him with a lot of that. So am I disappointed that he's not here? Maybe a little bit. You know, I'd like to see him in action and everything. I think everyone would like to see how well he'd hit in the Pacific Coast League.
Right.
But do I think he's ready for the Pacific Coast League? No, because I don't think he's ready to be part of a AAA clubhouse. I think he's very young. You know, he's even younger than his age. And I think he needs to grow up a bit. And we're not just talking the the reckless driving bit in the sports car. But, you know, you hear about, you know, him flipping the bat like that after hitting the home run.
I saw it. It was legendary. It was crazy. I was like,
it's the stuff a player his age at AA usually doesn't do. That's the veterans would drum that out of him. The thing is, Dodgers don't want him coming out here and doing that and having some 30-year-old journeyman sit there and like, I'm not letting that kid show me up again. I'm going to pop him right in the shoulder.
Right.
And
right.
Then, a 30-year-old journeyman at AAA can't necessarily play a baseball exactly where he wants to, otherwise he'd be in the big leagues. And next thing you know, on the ear.
Right.
And the Dodgers, you know, dealing with, you know, poor kid dealing, you know, got a concussion or.
Or he breaks his hand or, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, whatever it is. Yeah. So I think Puig is, he's where he needs to be, but it's clear that as much as he has the raw ability, he's still got a lot of work to do in terms of both maturing as a player and as a person.
And it was.
This level.
Yeah. And it was clear when he, you know, when he didn't walk in his first, you know, 65 at bats or whatever it was, even though he was hitting some like 570, you know, he just wasn't walking ever. And so, you know, you talk about a guy who doesn't take any pitches. Right. I mean, it's exciting. It's fun for fans to, you know, dream about and watch and everything else. But when it comes to actually playing against the best, you know, against the best pitchers that are out there, and AAA is, you know, one level down. That's right. Something to refine.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he's going to see a lot of pitching talent. You know, there's a lot of talented pitchers in the Southern League. Teams will kind of hoard guys in that league because it's a pitcher's league and it's safer for their psyches and everything else. So,
right. Okay.
You know, he's going to still see a lot of good pitching. He's going to see a lot of guys, you know, he's going to see guys who can throw two of the three pitches they need for strikes. And what he's got to learn to do right now, we know he can hit the fastball.
Right.
There's no question he can hit the fastball. He's got to learn to hit those breaking balls. He's got to learn to hit the big sliders and the 12-6 curves and everything else. And if he doesn't learn to do that, you know, big league pitchers will chew him up and spit him out. And even though, and, you know, and the big thing I hear from people is, well, but they're paying him so much money, don't they have to bring him up? No, they're the Dodgers now. They are now a $215 million payroll team. You know, so anytime somebody's like, well, they're not going to get rid of that guy because they don't want to buy out his contract, I'm like, you're kidding, right? Look
right.
How much money they just took off from Boston. Right. Money is not an issue.
Right.
I think the issue is with Puig, if any lessons had been learned from D. Gordon, but I would hope they apply to Puig, and I hope they apply to kids like Corey Seager last year, is be patient with your prospects. If the prospect forces the issue, move them up. But don't move him up because you suddenly think like, uh-oh, we need somebody to replace so-and-so at that position in 2 years. You know, don't do that. I would hope that they learn their lesson as far as that goes.
That's interesting, the connection that you make between Gordon and Puig as far as, you know, both being guys who have such, you know, clear, visible to the average Joe. It's not like a baseball scout says, ooh, that guy does this really well and nobody else really sees that. It's really easy to see for both of those guys. I mean, Puig, I think in the games that I saw, and I went to, I think, 3 or 4 total games in spring away and home, there was one where he, you know, dove for a ball that, you know, he might not have had a chance at, you know, rolled around in the outfield and got taken out of the game and ended up just being, you know, the wind knocked out of him. But you know, the next day then he hits a single that turns into a double and goes, you know, 3 for 4 or something ridiculous. And you know, the next day I saw him swing at a pitch that, you know, wasn't in the vicinity. So, you know, you start to put these things together and I hope that just like, you know, like you're saying that, as a fan of the Dodgers that they are patient, because that seems to be, definitely the way to go. I was thinking back, you know, right around the time that that the Dodgers had all those rookies of the year. There you go. In a row, including, you know, like you said, Nomo, Hollinsworth, Piazza, Karros, Mondesi. Those are the five, right? And not in that order, obviously. I was thinking about other guys who were kind of young during that time and maybe a little bit before that, or I think it was during that time, they had a minor leaguer named Billy Ashley And Billy Ashley used to come up and down. You know, he was one of the guys who got, you know, a cup of coffee from time to time. And I remember I went to Dodger Stadium once and he hit these home runs that were just ridiculous. And I think him and Konerko were coming up around, you know, the same time. Ashley might have been a little bit older, if I remember right.
Yeah, Ashley and Ron Coomer came up together.
Okay. Okay, so
yeah, they were part of the last team to win the PCL. That was in 1994.
94. Okay.
So it was during the strike. It was actually the strike was going on, and I remember listening to the last game. I think they played Vancouver, and they beat Vancouver on the road to win the PCL title. And somebody said, the radio announcer goes, "The last professional baseball game going on in North America." I just stuck out in my head because I was like, yeah, that's really true. You know, Major League Baseball is on strike. He was a tremendous power hitter here.
Yeah.
I think he hit a lot of big runs here that season. And Coomer was, I think he actually at third, and I think Coomer at cleanup. And Coomer ended up like 123 RBI, which is a lot for a 144 game minor league season.
Yeah, it is. And I just remember Ashley in batting practice he hit these balls that looked like they were going to go off the center field speakers at Dodger Stadium. And I remember thinking to myself, how is this guy not like on the team? How exciting would it be to watch this guy play every day? Imagine
the sprint said back in the day my friend and I played a lot more baseball than I did, so he could recognize things that maybe I couldn't as just a fan versus someone who played the game. A friend of mine looks at me one day and goes, "I think Billy Ashley's got a ton of power. He's a hole in the swing you could drive a Mack truck through." And at AAA, guys couldn't get away with it. At the big leagues, as soon as they found that hole, Billy Ashley was toast.
Right.
And I think it was one of the things where, he just had that tremendous raw power. Billy Ashley could kill a fastball.
Right.
Billy Ashley had a lot of trouble with the curveball.
So here's my question then.
The whole Pedro Serrano thing. Pedro Serrano. It was freaking all me like very much.
So
he needed Joe Boo to come.
His own personal version. So Billy Ashley, I imagine, would have been a fun player to watch in Albuquerque. Who's your favorite player to watch for Albuquerque, whether it be the Dukes or the Isotopes, as somebody who grew up in Albuquerque for all intents and purposes?
One of the favorite guys here, he played, I think, three and a half, maybe even four seasons here back in the 90s, was a first baseman by the name of Brian Traxler. Brian Traxler did not look like a baseball player. You know, he was short, stocky, a little mustache. But he was the nicest guy in the world. He autographed till his hand hurt. And he was just here. You know, he always put up good numbers, but that was the Eric Karras era. He couldn't get up. I think he got like, there was one year they called him up and he got, 15 at bats in September.
Okay.
He was one of the most popular guys here. And I think, that there was a familiarity with him. I think in the more recent years, John Lindsay was very, very popular at Simmons here. You know, just the big smile on his face. He was just a genuinely good guy, and you had to admire his perseverance. He was older than me, and he was still out here, trying to get up there.
And he did get up for the Dodgers.
Yeah. It meant much to everybody on that team to see him get up there finally. He was great. Jamie Hoffman was really a class guy here, and definitely the best player ever on the hill in center field. You know, we got one of those silly hills in center field.
You do?
And yeah. And they call it, somebody called it the Tope Slope. I said, that's stupid. It's Hoffman's Hill. As far as I'm concerned, the day Jamie Hoffman retires from professional baseball, you invite him back here and back out there and say, Hoffman's Hill. Nobody played this darn thing better. It's a tough thing. We were talking to Tony Gwynn Jr. about it the other day. He said, the main goal I learned on that hill is not fall flat on my face. that's kind of the goal. It's like, don't fall. You might not catch it, but just don't fall and, if it out there.
Awesome.
So Hoffman was popular. And for me personally, one of my favorite guys to interact with was J.D. Clauser. J.D. Clauser and I used to have this running banter every game, to the point of where some other players would come and be like, I'm concerned. Are you guys okay? And I'm like, no, we do this all the time. he would pull the, oh, it's the media's fault. And I would pull, oh, it's just player's fault. We would just joke back and forth like this, but we keep a straight face throughout it, the whole thing. And it was just good because, you know, Crosby would call you onto the carpet anytime he got the opportunity or something. You know, like you'd almost get hit by a foul ball, and Crosby's like, oh, my prayers were not answered. Stuff like that. And we used to trade that stuff. And John Eli, who should have been born left-handed, he was so eccentric sometimes. He really was a wonderful guy to talk to as well. So,
got it.
You know, there've been a lot of good ones who come and gone. You know, just some real players out here. It's like I said, I really never had any complaints about anybody I've interacted with either when I was a kid. You know, just out there looking for an autograph, or nowadays as a reporter. Talking to these guys.
Awesome. I have two quick questions left. One, who's somebody on the Isotopes who the Dodgers or Dodger fans may not be super familiar with, but who they may see someday and say, oh, wow, I can't believe I didn't know about that guy. Or is AAA more like a, I guess not to answer my own question, but is
team.
It's
kind of an extension of your bench and your bullpen in a lot of ways, your spot starters. I don't think there's anybody that quite fits that bill. I think the one guy, probably the most surprising guy on this year's team is Nick Buss, who more recently has been going by his actual middle name is Chili. His father gave him, you know, like Chili Davis, so Nick's middle name is Nicholas Chili Buss.
And he's a switch hitter, or is he a left-handed hitter?
He's an outfielder. He can play all three outfield positions.
Okay.
He played at USC.
Okay.
I think he was at USC like right after I left.
And he's a little guy.
He's not too small.
Maybe I'm picturing somebody else who was in the 90s in spring training. Tell me about Nick Buss.
Yeah, but he's kind of surprising. It's surprising he was on the team. I thought they were like, wow, they got a lot of left-handed hitting, you know, kind of scrappy center field types on this team.
Okay.
He's shown more power than I think I expected to see out of him. He's been a little bit of a surprise. And I think bullpen-wise, you know, two guys on the 40-man roster both here, and for the most part, it looked pretty good. Our Chris Withrow, you know, he's a former first-round pick. Maybe it was a bullpen full-time. And Steve Ames.
Okay.
Ames has put up really good numbers as a reliever in the minors. He probably just doesn't have the higher hype, you know.
Right.
But I think those are two guys, you know, who could help out in the a little bit. You know, they're both still pretty young and a little inconsistent at times. You know, Withrow's got a great fastball. He can throw 99.
Wow.
But the days Withrow goes 1-2-3, that's the days his breaking ball is working. On the days when Withrow is like, you know, a couple runners on, sweating it out on the mound, that's the day the breaking ball isn't working. So,
okay.
It's still kind of the issue with him. He tend to walk a few too many guys, but I think relief suits him better than starting would. I couldn't really imagine him as a starter.
Got it.
Those are kind of the guys maybe who are a bit flying under the radar here. But I think for the most part, the bulk of the, you know, the future starters, starting pitchers and starting position players, they're at Chattanooga right now.
Right. And that was kind of the Pui and Lee kind of conversation there.
Peterson.
Yeah.
Reed, Melky Garcia, those guys. Yeah.
Okay. And do you pay attention to those guys in Chattanooga? I mean, I guess you do. You know who they are just as part of your job, like you said.
Yeah, you keep an eye on them to some degree, you know. It's not one of those things where I check the box score every day on them or anything like that. But every now and again, I'll look down there and just see how they're doing.
Got it.
You try to keep track because you try to have a good idea. You know, if so-and-so gets in the big leagues and we lose so-and-so, who do we get?
Right.
A lot of times they'll kind of just plug in another veteran. They might sign a guy as a free agent or something, or pluck him out of the independent leagues or something like that.
Right.
But, you know, sometimes, you know, on occasion we've gotten guys up here from AA, but for the most part, the Dodgers' MO is kind of, they might move a guy between Great Lakes and Rancho or between Rancho and Chattanooga, but you don't see too many guys going from Chattanooga for half a year to Albuquerque. They tend to, if you start the year in Chattanooga, unless you're good enough to go to the big leagues, you're going to finish the year in Chattanooga.
Interesting.
They don't They don't tend to move them between AA and AAA, I think, just because it's a lot of a different environment. And I think there's a sense of they like to have guys have a full season of AA baseball before they bring them here.
Okay, last question. You're from Albuquerque. Put on your Chamber of Commerce hat here and tell me why somebody from California should come out for a long weekend or make it a point if they're driving across the country at some point or whatever to come out and catch an Isotopes game or to kind of hang out in Albuquerque for maybe a weekend series and see the Dodgers minor league team.
Well, I mean, it's affordable. You know, it's the ticket prices are very low. There's really not a bad seat in the house at the stadium. Honestly, I've been to 23 major league stadiums. It's pretty much as nice as a lot of those stadiums. It's nicer than some of them. It's a great place to see a game. In New Mexico, if you like the outdoors, you like to go hiking, you like to go camping, you know, we've got, you know, we're high desert, but we've got a lot of mountains, a lot of forests around here, very accessible to Albuquerque. You know, you've got, if you like art, you know, and jewelry and stuff like that, you know, Faye's right up here to the north. We've got a lot of it here in Albuquerque.
Yep.
The film industry is booming here.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about the film industry there.
It really is. Like I said, the guy I helped move today is a prop master on a lot of movies and TV shows that are filmed here.
Huh. I talked to a guy who works for the military as a film consultant. he's in the Army or the Marines, but he does like film consulting work or something where he goes and watches as they're shooting any one of, you know, a dozen blockbuster movies and basically tells them, yeah, we would do it that way. No, we don't do it that way. And so he has to spend time in Albuquerque that way. He goes out from LA.
Yeah. And another thing about Albuquerque that I'm also involved in is we have we're fast evolving in one of the best cities for microbrews in the country.
Okay.
We really have some award winning, you know, I mean, not just like, we're not winning awards here in state, we're winning awards at the Great American Beer Festival, you know, the big one. You know, we've got Marble Brewing here, La Cumbre, Nexus, Tractor, Il Vicino, Broken Bottle, Bosque, Chama River, Turtle Mountain, you know, and so on and so forth. I apologize to anything I leave out. But, yeah, the quality of our local beer here and up in Santa Fe is really outstanding. There's a lot of, I mean, there's stuff here that will rival that you might get out there at Firestone Walker or at Stone or Rogue or
Shoot. Firestone Walker is total local brewery here, so. Way to go! That's right here, absolutely.
We've really had kind of a big boom in that lately, and the food here I think is outstanding. A lot of it's too spicy for me to eat. But if you like spicy food, you'll love coming to New Mexico.
It's the place for sure. So,
cool. Yeah, and the biggest thing is compared to California, it's cheap.
It's cheap. It's really cheap, an easy vacation if you can get it.
In a really nice hotel for what it would cost for a mid-range hotel in LA or San Francisco.
Yeah, I do feel like you could go out to some nice restaurants, do like a real kind of high-end vacation, I guess, kind of on the cheap. Especially if you can get a cheap plane ticket, you know, out there, you could really get there and have it be a pretty easy thing.
Yeah, and then the locals here, they're smart. You know, maybe not about everything, you know, they know to respect people from coming in from out of state, and they know how important tourism is in New Mexico. So, you know, you go to Isotopes games, you're not going to get anybody in your face. You're not going to get anybody yelling at you because you're wearing the wrong jersey or something like that. It's a good environment, you know, and there's lots of stuff for the kids to do. If you got, you know, if your kids are too young for you to, you know, you're worried, like, I can't imagine sitting still for 3 hours at a baseball game. There's plenty of stuff for them to do at the ballpark. They got a little playground out in right field even for the kids. So
excellent. Well, it's definitely on my list of things to do. I had Las Vegas on my list of things to do too, but never got out there during the baseball season when the Dodgers moved there. And I think Albuquerque's worth a shot at some point in my travels when we get when the stars align for sure to be able to get out there. But Chris Jackson, I really do appreciate the time today. Of course, you can find Chris's articles and stories on is it AlbuquerqueExaminer.com?
Examiner.com.
Just Examiner.com.
Yeah, if you pretty much just look at, if you look on Google and you search Albuquerque Isotopes, I'm usually like the, you know, there's like the team site, and then I think I'm second. So
yeah, absolutely.
If you Google Isotopes, and you know, and on Twitter, just you know, you can find me as Topes Writer, and I tweet pretty frequently, especially when they're at home, and you know. I try not to be too snarky. I kind of leave that to others.
The big league guys could be that way.
They thrown another team mad at me last year, so I gotta watch myself. Some of the players' wives now follow me on Twitter, so I'm like, oh dear.
Yeah, covering the local university here, I always you know, college kids, I always kind of go back and forth, you know, as far as how much to, how snarky to get, or, you know, are they going to get my sarcasm in this case? Because it's actually funny if you read it sarcastically. And, you know, you got to kind of worry sometimes about that, you know, whether it's, you know, a professional situation or a college situation too. And we'll be keeping an eye out on New Mexico. And if Cal Poly and New Mexico both win the super regionals or win their regionals and make it to a super regional, I'll definitely be hitting you up again.
I have no idea which of them would host. I have no idea because I don't think either of them have the facility to host. So they'd be one of the weird things. They'd have to find like a neutral site or something. But
Poly, you know, Poly has a decent stadium, but I don't know what they require for a super regional.
They tried to wedge a regular regional into Pepperdine once, and it was a nightmare. It just wasn't nearly big enough. And it's hard for them enough at UCLA every year. You know, Fullerton's made for a regional. It's a big stadium. The Lobos' problem is since they play on their own field now, the field's really nice. They redid the field. That part's nice, but the stands are small.
Right.
They haven't gotten around to get enough fundraising to build up the stands yet, and they don't have lights. That's the big thing.
Yeah, Baggett's got lights, and it's been redone in the last, it's a new stadium, I think, in the last 10 years or so. It was going to be, and so it's you know, Big West, you know, I'd say I haven't been to a lot of the other ones, but Big West is a decent baseball conference, and I think they had about 2,000 or 3,000 people in there for some games this year, so you never really know, but maybe it'd be somewhere in between or whatever, but I think, you know, Cal Poly's a 2, and New Mexico's a 3. I would think that out of one of the other 4 or one of the other 2 teams would probably be a number 1, and so you'd be looking at something closer to that, maybe. I don't know. At any rate, if that happens, which is, you know, pretty small chance of both of them making it through, I'd say. But if it does, I'll definitely hit you up in the next couple weeks. And if not, then I'll definitely want to talk to you at the end of the season to kind of wrap up the Isotope season and what things look like for the Dodgers in the future. Chris Jackson from the Albuquerque Examiner, examiner.com. I really appreciate you joining our podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Hang on one second here.